Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, broadcasting all around the Alpha Quadrant. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And he's here, the great one himself, the president of Ignatius Press, the most important publisher in the Alpha Quadrant, Mark Brumley. Hello, Mark Brumley.
Hello to you, sir. You're looking so good.
Thank you. Thank you.
You said that to me before.
Thank you for lying. I appreciate the lie.
No, man, you're looking great.
I appreciate it. Well, I'm still upright. And your most troublesome employee, Father David McConey, was on with us the previous hour. So hello to you from Father David McConey.
Oh, he's awesome.
Okay, so you have books. You got just stacks of books behind you. You're the head of a company that publishes, I don't know, upwards of 10, 11 books a year. How many do you publish? How many do you actually publish?
40 to 60.
40 to 60
and
books.
That's not counting reprints, of course. We've got tons of reprints.
So I want to start by asking you this. I mean, you're a convert to the Catholic faith. My personal favorite convert, and I don't say
really?
That. Do not say that to Tim or Jimmy or Trent. So you're a convert. That's all right. I say the same to them when you're not around. Here we are at Catholic Answers Live talking about books. Books are actually central. They play a central part in our Catholic faith, and they have a special role in the life of a human being in general. What is it about them? Why? Why are they so important, essential, special, especially to a Catholic?
Well, books are a way to remember. I mean, they're a way of transmitting and part of tradition and all of that, you know. But I'm going to say, people sometimes say, well, you know, books are not all that important. I mean, you read literary people, yeah, they're great for you, but they're not really all that important. But stop and think about the fact that God wrote a book. God wrote a book. So books have to be pretty important if God took the time to write a book. And he didn't just write a book. He wrote it over a long period of time. And he collaborated with human beings. And, of course, it's the book of books. It's called the Bible, right? So God chose to reveal himself in human history, you know, the creator of the universe, make himself known. He did that through various deeds and words throughout history. But these things were written down in a book. And not just written down by some, you know, schmoes somewhere, but divinely inspired in the writing. So books are very, very important. They're at the heart of Christianity and Judaism, Islam, different ways, especially with respect to Islam. But, you know, Christianity, we have the Bible. It's at the heart of our faith. And human history. I mean, the fact of the matter is the invention of writing, the invention of the book, moving from you know, writing on scrolls and into the book form, the codex as they call it, tremendously important. And of course, the printing press, which makes books widely and relatively inexpensively available to everybody, just revolutionized human existence. So, books are important. They're very important. They connect us to the past. They prepare us for the future, and they help interpret our present.
888-318-7884 if you'd like to get in on our conversation with Mark Brumley about books and about the relationship between books and the Catholic life. I'm going to make a confession to you, Mark, and then I want to ask you about books in your life. And my confession to you is this, and I am not sure if it's because I'm getting older or if it's because of the invention of the cell phone, but I'm finding it harder to read books in recent years, to finish the book, to, you know. I'm reading a wonderful book right now, but even as I'm reading it, I have this anxiety. Am I really going to finish this? It's about Crown Prince Carl, Blessed Carl of Austria, and I want to finish it. It's just a great book, but I don't trust myself anymore. Do you think – I don't think I'm the only one either. I think a lot of people are having trouble reading.
I think you're right. I have some ideas about that, not completely homegrown ideas of things I've read. About that, I'll say this. People ask me sometimes, do you have trouble reading? You know, how do you find time to read and all of that? I'll say, generally, I don't have trouble reading. I find time to read. Part of it is my job, but part of it is a passion and a love. And part of it is a result of discipline.
Okay.
But I'm going to say, yeah, from time to time, when I've done a lot of internet activity, I will often find it difficult to focus my attention in reading. And I think that that's, I think there's science behind that, that the things that we do with our brain that are involved in the internet, especially with social media or texting or things of that sort, Twitter is just a disaster for this. Not saying don't use Twitter, but I'm just saying just be aware that kind of stimulation that we get through the interaction of social media, especially and the internet, I think it tends to make it difficult to get the same kind of beneficial feedback in reading books that we used to. I don't think that means that we should give up our social media or our computers or anything like that. I do think it means we need to be disciplined in the use of them, and we need to become disciplined in what we read and how we read. But I relate to what you're saying because I, you know, from time to time I have that struggle too. And I think the way I work through it is I just decide I'm going to use this. I'm going to use my cell phone less. I'm going to use social media less. I'm going to focus my time when I'm reading my book on the reading of my book.
And there is something that, you know, I suppose even the internet and all these things that you just mentioned, they actually make it harder for us to experience nature as well. I mean, just sit on your front porch and and I think there's a relationship in the soul expanding value of nature in books, that they actually expand our soul in a similar way, the natural world and the world of books.
Yeah, and you know, Father Fessio is founder, president, or and editor of Ignatius Press. You know, he when the Hobbit movies came, when the Lord of the Rings movies came out, you know, Tolkien was a big figure for Father, and he loved Lord of the Rings, read Lord of the Rings, and he was just not really enthusiastic about watching the Lord of the Rings movies because he said he didn't want to sort of subject his imagination to the tyranny of someone else's interpretation of these books. Now, I'm not anti-movie, and I can make an argument, and did make an argument in the time in the other direction on this, but he made an observation which I think is key here. You know, you say a picture is worth a thousand words. And he said, you know, one word is worth a thousand pictures. And what he meant by that is that the printed word requires the use of our own imagination in a way that watching a film does not. And I say, what the heck does this have to do with your comment about nature? Well, I'm going to say this. I think the printed word allows us to draw from our experiences of the world, including our experiences of the natural world.
Right, right.
So that when we read a book, the reading of that book is stimulated by the other things that we've experienced, especially in the world of nature. C.S. Lewis wrote a wonderful book called Perelandra. It's part of his so-called space trilogy.
Yeah.
It's a book about a trip to Venus. And in that, he's got these wonderful floating islands that go up and down and up and down. And Lewis said that he was – he once received a letter from a lady who had read the book, but she had a terrible time with it because the description of the floating islands made her seasick.
Yeah,
well,
right.
Well, Lewis loved that because what did that mean? It meant that he was able to evoke in through reading the experience of something from the physical world. And I think your point about the internet and computers and all of that can cause us to lose touch with the physical world. Books kind of put us back in touch with the visible, the physical world. I think that that's a key insight to the power of literature that some use of the internet doesn't have. It can inhibit. So I think we need to be aware of that. Sure.
I know that for myself, I've never had an experience of reading on the internet, and I read a lot on the internet that is anything that's quite even analogous to the experience of reading a good book, that there's a spiritual level to the reading of the good book that I don't even mean that it's necessarily a spiritual book. It's just that your spirit, your soul, your rational being is engaged by a book in a way that nothing else can engage you.
I agree with that. And it's one of the reasons I hope that people call in and tell us books, give us the names of books that have engaged them, that have been transformative in their lives. You know, if people have questions about what should I read about this, what should I read about that, that's fine. I'm happy to talk about that. I just want to say at the outset, you know, I don't regard myself to use the term from, you know, by Otto Bird. We published a book biography of the great philosopher Otto Bert called Seeking a Center. His life is a great bookie. My life is a great bookie. I'm not a great bookie. By that I mean I do try to read the great books, but I don't regard myself as, you know, a master of the great books. Mortimer Adler, of course, who was famous with Robert Hutchins for promoting the reading of the great books, once said that he thought that he had, after many, many years of studying philosophy and reading the great books from ancient times, medieval times, up to modern times, these great, great books, and discussing them over the years, that he thought he had become a generally educated man when he turned 60.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not too far from 60. I don't think I'm there yet. So I don't regard myself as an expert on the great books, but I do regard myself as a passionate reader and a professional reader. And so I think it's important to talk about books, to read books, and so on. So I hope we have a good time discussing books today.
888-318-7884. If you do want to share books that have made a difference in your life, and especially maybe if they've made a difference in your conversion or the deepening of your conversion,
yes.
I want to ask you about the relationship between your conversion to the Catholic faith and books, if you will do that when we come back.
Sure, absolutely.
I do have an appointment, an important announcement to make to the people of the earth when we come back, however, first.
Okay.
This is not an announcement for Americans. This is an announcement to our listeners in, say, Australia and Singapore and the Philippines, in Africa, in Europe. Wow. Americans are about to do something really dumb, and it's going to have an influence on you, and I'm going to make an announcement about it when we come back right after this.
Call now, Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
When I begin my prayer time, I always enter into it with the expectation that God wants to teach me something. And it has to start with my willingness to share my heart with God, not just say words at Him. So whether I'm using more formal prayers or a more conversational style of prayer, I have to bring my heart and my life and my real self to God. And by having that dialogue, we're able to enter into a deeper relationship, and He's able to show me how to use all the events of my life to draw closer to Him.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I have to make my announcement to the people of the earth first about something dumb that Americans are about to do and that will impact you if you are a listener of this show, and then we will get back to books with Mark Brumley. On Saturday evenings, Americans will do that dumb thing they do every year. We're going to set our clocks back 1 hour. So if you are listening around the world in a place where they sensibly do not change their clocks twice a year, that means you're going to have to listen at a different time. So if you're in Sydney, we're not going to be on it. I'm not even going to try to guess what hour we're on or which direction it goes. I cannot figure it out. That's why I think it's a dumb thing to do. But I do want to warn you, if you're listening in the United Kingdom now or Nigeria or anywhere in Asia or you're anywhere else on earth, we're going to change our clocks on Saturday night. And so on Monday, when you come back to listen, we'll be on, I don't know what direction it goes, ahead or back or something like that, but just it's going to be an hour different. And if you can't guess, I'm really against this changing of the clocks. Mark Brumley.
Really? Is this official Catholic Answers policy?
This is official teaching of the church, I believe. It is not official church teaching.
Infallible.
It's just common sense. Why are we changing the clocks all the time? We're just upsetting ourselves. I think it's bothering the animals. I don't think they like it. Our lights come on earlier in the morning. They're very confused by this. I apologize to all of our listeners in sensible countries, but in America, we change our clocks, and so it'll be different on Monday. Mark Brumley, tell us a little bit about the role that books played in your conversion to the Christian faith and to the Catholic faith.
Huge role. I have to say, you know, I grew up, people have heard this before, listening to the show on a regular basis. You know, I grew up a South St. Louis unaffiliated theist, and I used to be a nun. Many people don't know that. people say, hey, you used to be a nun? Wow, gee, you wound up in the right place. You're in the Bay Area, right? And I say, no, not an N-U-N, but an N-O-N-E. I was a nun, a nun of the above, unaffiliated with any particular religion. My parents believed in God, raised me to believe in God, but I didn't have any – we were unchurched. We were what we nowadays call unchurched, right? But I was interested in spiritual things, and partly through the influence of my parents, but also through the influence of three sisters who lived up the street, older sisters. They were one was a widow, and the other two had been single. One had been a nun. She'd been in the convent, out of the convent, and the other just was a single lady, and they taught school. And so they exposed me to a wonderful world of books and books about religion. And they gave me my first Bible. I got a Today's English Version of the New Testament from them, and I read that, loved it. But the thing is, you know, so as I was trying to come to understand who Jesus was, you know, I watched televangelists and people like that and talked to friends. But the thing, the book that was – this is in many ways ironic, but – you know, if God can use Balaam's ass, he could use this book, and he did use this book. The book that really helped me find Christ and at least understand who Jesus was a book called Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey.
Oh, my gosh. That book drove me crazy back in the 80s. I was so scared.
So what this is Hal Lindsey was a Protestant evangelical. I think he's still alive. Very old guy if he's still alive. But, you know, he – had a conversion experience, come to Christ, and he was very influenced by what's called dispensational theology, which was a way of interpreting Bible, and he was very influenced by Bible prophecy, so-called Bible prophecy, which is a way of understanding the Bible, taking passages of Scripture that either are prophetic or are interpreted as being prophetic, and using them as ways of interpreting what's going on in the world around us. In Late Great Planet of the Earth, but as you can tell by the title, it was about the end of the world, the end of the world's coming soon. And, you know, Lindsey purported to take Scripture and interpret it and apply it to world events. And, you know, this was after the Arab-Israeli conflicts of 68 and I think before 72. But at any rate, But the thing about this book, and I, you know, he pushed the rapture the big way. Jesus is coming again. He's going to take all true believers out of the world and all that sort of thing. That fascinated me. But, you know, I would say apart from it, all this Bible prophecy stuff, the thing it did is help explain the gospel to me. Well, who Jesus was, how Jesus died for my sins. I mean, I'd heard these things being an American young person, you know, in the 60s and 70s and watching televangelists and, you know, Billy Graham and all that. But it didn't really click for me until I read that book. And so I asked Jesus to be my personal Lord and Savior and had a conversion experience to Christianity. And that book was pivotal. But with respect to my growth in Christian faith, it was C.S. Lewis. He was the man. You know, Lewis was the guy that really helped me understand Christianity, what Christianity is all about. And the key book there was Mere Christianity. So I had these books, and I the other day I mentioned this before the beginning of the show. The other day I was in my garage and I came across a pile of lists that I had made, and there were two kinds of lists. There were the lists that I had made before I became a Catholic, while I was still trying to figure out, you know, what is the true faith? I mean, where's the fullness of Christianity and so on? So that was a list of books. And then I had another list of books that I had made, and I was pretty dutiful about it, because I had the titles there. I had either the Dewey Decimal numbers or the Library of Congress numbers or whatever there.
Wow.
You know, because I come from St. Louis, and I would go to the library and look up books, right? And I'd come up with this list of books, and then these were books I was either reading or I was going to read. And so this list of books that, you know, what is true Christianity and so on, and people who have heard my testimony know that I was trying to figure out which church I should join, you know, I should have baptized me, because I had, you know, although I had made a profession of faith in Christ, I had not been baptized, but I didn't want to be baptized by the Whore of Babylon church. I wanted to be baptized in, you know, by the true church. So I had to figure that out, you know, and so I had a long list of books. C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. Lewis was an Anglican, but he tried to write the book. He didn't completely succeed, but he tried to write the book in a way that would be very acceptable for Catholics, Anglicans, Methodists, and I can't remember what the fourth category of Christian was that he had run the manuscript by. But I just, this book was life transforming to me, because where Hal Lindsey's late great Planet Earth, you know, kind of called me a point of conversion, accept Jesus as my personal Lord and Savior, and gave me just a very rudimentary understanding of that. It also gave me a lot of nonsense, sorry, Hal, that I had to deal with. C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity really kind of explained the nuts and bolts of the Christian faith in a way that was just very transformative. It was intellectually accessible and appealing, but it was also it was very spiritual. So it wasn't just a head trip kind of book. It was a book that called me to deeper conversion, helped me understand, well, what do we Christians mean about by the Trinity? What do they mean when they talk about God being, you know, eternal and things like that?
Yeah.
You know, just really basic stuff. Anyway, that was a huge book for me. And then with respect to my conversion to Catholicism, oh boy, Chesterton's Orthodoxy, his book Everlasting Man, Frank Sheets' Theology and Sanity. I had a good friend who was a Catholic, and I was always trying to convert him. He wasn't as well-formed in his faith as he should have been. I was always trying to convert him, and I used to say, well, you know, if Catholicism was so great, is so great, where's the Catholic C.S. Lewis, right?
Oh, and then you found Chesterton. Yeah,
which is completely naive and stupid on my part,
right?
You know, given the breadth of the Catholic tradition. And he didn't really know much, but he said, well, you know, my dad keeps trying to get me to read this book. So he walked over and picked the book up off the shelf. No, it wasn't Chesterton. It was Frank Sheed.
Oh.
And it was the book Theology and Sanity. And I went through that book and I was amazed. I mean, here was somebody who could present Catholicism in an accessible way to me. And I was in high school, right? So I'm a high school kid at this point. Present Catholicism to me in an accessible way, the way Lewis presented, you know, so-called Mere Christianity or Christianity in a general way. And so that book was hugely successful. So, and I started reading Chesterton, by the way, through Lewis, because Lewis would refer to Chesterton. So I read Orthodoxy, Everlasting Man. I read Frank Sheed's Theology and Sanity, a key book for me. I read Ronald Knox's Belief of Catholics, which I thought was absolutely crazy. Reasons I won't go into. Anyway, so long and short of it, I had these two lists. These were key titles on my first list, books that helped me bring me to the Catholic faith. And I remember, so this is in the mid to late 1970s, and some of these books were hard to come by, right? So I'd go to used bookstores, and I began to think, well, you know, what's going on? I can't get these books anywhere. But they were extremely helpful, and I would give copies. Another book I didn't mention was a book by Carl Adam, whom I called Carl Adam at the time, but Carl Adam, a German theologian, what's called The Spirit of Catholicism. And that book just knocked my socks off because it kind of made a biblical case for the Catholic Church. And this is, you know, at a time when I didn't know any evangelical converts. The only one I knew had converted, and he really wasn't talking much about his conversion and certainly hadn't written a book, was John Michael Talbot, you know, who was an evangelical Christian musician who had had a conversion experience and had become a Catholic in the process. And that was it. I didn't know anybody else
was making that trip.
There was no one else. So I couldn't go read Rome Sweet Home by Scott Hahn because it didn't exist. Now, Peter Kraft had been a convert. He was a convert from evangelicalism, but I didn't know of him. And he really wasn't writing books of the kind of books he came to write later on.
Yeah.
So
listening to your story, it puts me in the mind of that a kind of almost an image of various conversations going on. And there's the kind of surface conversation that our culture has, and we wage that conversation through pop culture, movies and
right.
radio programs and television shows and magazines. But the conversation, Hal Lindsey was your entry into a conversation that's much on a much deeper level than the general conversation. It's like going into another room. And I'm sure it does matter in many ways, but it almost doesn't matter which book is the book that gets you down into that room. Once you get there, if you keep pursuing it, you end up with Frank Sheed or G.K. Chesterton or You know, ultimately, you're going to end up reading Aquinas and Aristotle and the Bible and all this. But you got to get into that stuff. All that stuff. Yeah, all that stuff that made us, the stuff that makes us. But that conversation that's under the wider conversation, if you won't read books, you won't get into that conversation. You're not going to end up
there.
That's
right. That's right. And I didn't read these books in the optimal way. I mean, I read them as motivated readers, and that really helps. If you approach a book and you say, I've got a problem and I want this book to help me, that's being a motivated reader. Or if you pick up a title and you say, this book is provocative, or I'm going to see the provocation of this book and I'm going to be a motivated reader, that's important. So I had that. But what I didn't have was somebody to read with. And as Adler said, solitary reading is like solitary drinking. You should read with other people. And that gets you into the conversation.
All right, callers, I've kept you waiting long enough. We're going to get to your books, your book suggestions, your ideas about the importance of reading books, especially in the Catholic context, right after this.
Catholic Answers Live. We're here for you.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
If you spend any time on Twitter, Facebook, or mainstream media, you're probably familiar with the litany of slogans that skeptics employ to rescue you from the foolish belief that God exists. The constant onslaught seems to leave people with the idea that they have no alternative but to embrace atheism. How can a Christian respond? In One Less God Than You, John DeRosa breaks down 20 of the most common atheist challenges and shows you how to craft effective answers. Atheism is more aggressive and widespread than ever. Read One Less God Than You and prepare yourself to respond with the joyful truth that God is real. To get your copy of One Less God Than You, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. We're talking books. With the man responsible for getting out a whole bunch of the best books you get to read each year, Ignatius Press. From Ignatius Press, Mark Brumley is the president of Ignatius Press. We have to get to callers, though, in all fairness. So
yes.
We're going to go to Jane in El Paso, Texas, listening on EWTN Radio. Jane, delighted to have you for our books conversation. Go ahead with your question or comment or whatever else you got.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
My comment is, my very favorite book in the whole world is Come Rack, Come Rope by Monsignor Benson, and it is out of print in a book form. I ordered it from Amazon, and when I reread it, they were missing chapters, which were like the key chapters, and I don't know if you guys have either read that. It's a historical fiction, but it's a beautiful book on martyrdom. But there's a beautiful book, a beautiful part about vocation. And I always recommend it to my young people when I talk about marriage and priesthood because
Wonderful.
It's just so great.
Mark, what do you know about Come Rack, Come Rope?
Well, it is, as she says, a beautiful book. I don't want to say anything about the publisher. You and I were talking off air that I thought that book was in print.
But she's saying chapters are missing from the current print version.
So that's good to know. I mean, it's not good to know that there are chapters missing, but it does mean that there's a place for a new edition or new printing of it. I I think that book has come up as a possible candidate for what's called Ignatius Critical Editions. It's a series of classic works that we published at Ignatius Press. If it hasn't been included in that list, Joseph Pierce, if he's listening, who's the general editor, is going to say, ah, I got Brumley. He's committed on the air to do this, which I'm not doing. But I do think it would be something for us to consider. So thank you for mentioning it. And, you know, in a kind of a indirect way, thank you for telling us that the print edition that's out there is inadequate.
It's incomplete, yeah. So that's a complete commitment, Jane. He's going to do it at Ignatius Press. Did you catch that?
I will love you forever, because I read it about 22 years ago when my daughter was – I always figure out what I was reading when my babies were born, and, you know.
Oh, so yeah.
She was just born. So I read it 22 years ago, and then I ordered it off of Amazon because Sophia Institute Press is the one that originally, that's how I was introduced to that whole publishing company. And then they don't make it. And so right. I went secular to Amazon, and yeah. They're missing chapters, and it's just, it's like sacrilegious. I don't know. It's just.
Yeah, but that's how you feel, though. Yeah. When you love a book, this is a part of you. This is not,
right.
This is no longer negotiable. It'd be like, you know, if somebody took some chapters out of The Lord of the Rings for me, it'd be like, wait, excuse me, that's like.
You can't do that.
That's an amputation. All right, so we have a rock solid commitment from. That's it. Thanks, Jane. Thanks very much.
I think Joseph Pierce is calling my phone right now. No.
let's continue our conversation about books, especially if those books have had anything to do with your conversion or for the deepening of your conversion to faith. But we just love talking about books, too, and spending time with Mark Brumley. And it's all good. Let's go to Bob in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. You there with us, Bob?
Yeah, hello.
Hi, Bob. What do you got for us?
You guys always say that the Bible is a Catholic book. The Bible is a Catholic book, and definitely Moby Dick is a Catholic novel.
Oh,
just wow. That theme that runs through there is one of the seven deadly sins, wrath. And what it does to a person, if they just hold that grudge, cut people out of your lives, like we see today. I mean, how many phone calls do you get? Somebody has a political belief, but my son cut me out of my life. My brother doesn't talk to me. Like, and it just illustrates Captain Ahab, what kind of person that it turns you into if you're going to hold a grudge.
Yeah.
And ultimately, what it does to even the innocent people that have nothing to do with that grudge, it ruins everybody.
How old were you when you first read Moby Dick?
I was probably 30.
Uh-huh. And it
and
just grabbed you.
I wish I would have known that theme a little bit better in there.
Mark?
But there's a great... go ahead. But there's a great line in there at the beginning, right? Not the bad thing, but the great metaphor for our worldview that the world is a ship on its passage out, and
it's good.
The pulpit is its prow. I mean,
that's a very New England thing to say. Very, very New England thing to say. Well, I have to admit now to not having read Moby Dick, and I believe Moby Dick. Oh, Marie looks utterly shocked, and that's the thing about Moby Dick is. More people, it's the book that more people feel guilty about not having read than maybe any other book ever been written. Mark,
War
did you want to
peace,
make a comment on Moby Dick?
Oh, there's a lot we could say about Moby Dick. It certainly is a great book. And by the way, I'm not going to miss the opportunity to alert listeners to the fact that Moby Dick is one of the volumes in the Ignatius Critical Edition series.
Oh.
Which has these wonderful annotations and essays to help the reader fully benefit from the reading of this classic book. So I want people to go out and get a copy, not just of Moby Dick, that's good, but get the Ignatius Critical edition of Moby Dick. So that's one point I want to say. The other thing I want to say about Moby Dick is I think everything the caller said about Moby Dick is true. There might be some qualifications I want to make here and there, but the key, I think, for a lot of people is some, I would say about it, something that I heard said in a lecture recently about Silas Marner, you know, by George Eliot, which is a 19th century novel.
George Eliot was a lady.
George Eliot was a lady. That's right.
I just I love saying that because it makes me look so
smart.
That's
a whole conversation in its own right.
Go ahead.
This lecture said of Silas Marner, it's a great book if you don't read it too young. Now.
Oh, how interesting.
What I think he meant by that is that oftentimes we're introduced to these books at an age where our experience is negative. And I don't think that that's essential. I don't think it's the case that it has to be. But it takes more teaching ability and more teaching prep and more teaching talent to teach Moby Dick to a ninth grader than it takes to teach Moby Dick to a college student or to a young adult. Now, things have changed a lot with respect to readers, so maybe that statement is not we want to qualify it even more. But I think that that's true. I had the experience, now maybe a year or so ago, maybe it's more like 2 years now, of rereading the Iliad by Homer. Right now. So this is a book I supposedly read in high school, which I really didn't.
Oh.
And then, you know, because I was a double major, history and education major in college, I read the Iliad in college. Okay. But when I just reread it, you know, as a married man with five children who raised five children, it was like reading a completely different book.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah.
The perspective that I brought of someone who had lived, you know, a fair amount of life was completely different from what I brought when I first looked at that. I won't even dignify the expression reading it or read it in high school, because I didn't really read. I certainly read it cover to cover. And what I read of it, I wasn't taught how to read and benefit from reading even at the level I could have benefited from as a high school student. I'm not here to trash my high school education, but that's the case. So I think that often happens with these books.
But it often happens with people too, though, that you're really not ready to be a book reader in high school. There's people that are just not. And I my wife is one of these people who when she's about in her early to mid 30s, she starts this daily reading thing, and she's like, I can do it now. I understand what these novelists are talking about. I understand what this – it just all kind of comes together in a clear way. And then she got smarter than me. It ruined our marriage.
There you go.
Okay, that's not true. That part's not true. I have to mention a Catholic Answers book, One Less God Than You, How to Answer the Slogans, Clichés, and Fallacies of the Atheists Used to Challenge Their Faith. The reason I have to mention this is because Mark mentioned a book from Ignatius Press, and I'm not allowed to let him mention a book from Ignatius Press without mentioning a book from Catholic Answers Press.
We're going to be distributing that book too, so people can get it from us as well as from you.
Knock it off, Mark. But Bob, thank you for testimony to Moby Dick, and also just the idea. I mean, he's 30 years old when he read it, and he can see it. At 30, you can go, "Oh, this is what this is about."
That's right.
And I imagine even for the author, Nathaniel Hawthorne. Herman Melville is what I meant to say. I don't know where that came from, but for Melville too, you can almost tell in the writing that he's getting it. Okay, I've read some of Moby Dick, all right? That the metaphors are grabbing him too while he's writing it, and the book is becoming in some ways something magnificent for him that maybe he didn't expect when he started writing it.
Thank you, Ishmael.
You're welcome. I don't know why I said Nathaniel Hawthorne. The other day I mixed up Goliath and Samson on the air. It's a Catholic radio program. I got those two mixed up. Peggy,
At least you didn't get Samson and Hercules mixed up.
That's true. Yeah, that would be worse, putting a pagan in there. Yeah, I agree with you. We're talking Catholic books with Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press and a bookie, as he says himself. He's not going to take your bets, but he's a bookie. He loves those books. There are some books that never leave you, Mark. They leave a mark on you. And I've mentioned this to you before, and I'm just going to say it before I go to the break, and then we'll go to Peggy in Auburn, Nebraska. The 12 years old, Easter break, I somehow end up, I know why, because my friend Matt Hewitt told me, you got to read this. And I over Easter break, end up reading and not being able to do anything else, being paralyzed by The Lord of the Rings. I know everybody's seen the movies and everything, but if you discover this in the 1970s when no one is talking about it, you've never heard of it before, someone puts it in your hand and you just read it, life trans. No other book will ever have the effect that The Lord of the Rings had on me. And I am so grateful that it was such a Catholic book. I think it formed me as a Catholic person for the rest of my life. Like it made an imprint on me.
Frodo lives.
Frodo lives. All right. That's all you got for me. All right.
I agree with you. I agree with you. My Christian experience as an evangelical when I was first a fundamentalist made me very suspicious of Tolkien. And I didn't want to read Lord of the Rings. I didn't want to read The Hobbit I thought they were pagan, and partly because the people in high school that really got into Tolkien were druggies.
Yeah, they did.
To be honest. And there were wizards and all of that.
The druggies.
Lewis helped me overcome that. And when I read Lord of the Rings, I was like blown away. I was like, what in the world? What was I thinking? Why was I against this? But that's right. That's right. These books can be transformative. And Lord of the Rings is a transformative set of books for me. I will say Till We Have Faces by C.S. Lewis is a transformative book for me.
Yeah.
Certainly the Space Trilogy. Chronicles of Narnia. You know, I got the Chronicles of Narnia for Christmas. And over Christmas break, I read all seven of them. How important they are.
I'll tell you what, I am going to the break, but this also makes me very, very anxious and bothered by the current state of what's called the young adult literature, young adult novel, because those kids who are reading a lot of that stuff, they're being imprinted in a way that you don't want your kids to be imprinted. Parents have got to be awfully careful about that. All right, Peggy, we're coming to you right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Check out EW10's official YouTube channel.
Just follow the link on our homepage at EWTN.com or go to YouTube.com/EWTN.
Watch EWTN's live shows or today's homily from the Daily Mass.
Click the upload button to see our most recent clips.
You can also find all of EWTN YouTube content by clicking the playlist button.
It's all on the official EWTN YouTube channel at YouTube.com/EWTN.
Visit today.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
All right, Brumley, look, it's all callers from now to the end of the show. You got it? It's all callers.
We'll do our best.
We're talking books with Mark Brumley, the head in charge of books for all Catholics because he's the president of Ignatius Press. We go down to Peggy in Auburn, New Mexico, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Peggy, sorry to keep you waiting.
Auburn, Nebraska.
Oh,
okay.
I'm having a terrible day.
Mexico's a great state, too.
Yes, and Nathaniel Hawthorne is a great author, too, but you got to say the right thing.
He is a great author.
That's one of the rules. Go ahead, Peggy.
Yes.
Save me, Peggy. Save me.
I have two great books. I'm a credo Catholic. I was confirmed in the Catholic Church on Pentecost Sunday of this year, and I have two great books that kind of helped me along. The first one, my mentor, teacher from RCIA, let me borrow, and I just now returned it to him because I got my own, and it's The Faith Explained by Leo Treese. I think it's a great book.
I'm sorry that I don't know it. You know it, Mark?
Yes. When I was exploring Catholicism, I bought a copy at a used bookstore or something like that, and it was very, very helpful. Yeah.
What was the second one?
It gets down to the basics. Confession, St. Augustine. He's like us. He's naughty and...
Yeah, like you and Mark, you mean.
And he just...
Not like Cy.
And Well, I don't know. he's like
so,
all of us. Come
so
on.
So when did you?
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
When did you yeah. first read Confessions by Augustine? When did you first read it?
Oh, not until I became Catholic. Father Carl, our parish priest, it might have been his feast day. I can't remember. August. Wait, let me look inside the book. I write when I get it, the date that I got the book.
Oh,
maybe it was before the feast day. I know that's kind of funny, but it was before his feast day because I got it in June, and his feast day is August. So, but I'd already been confirmed, so I was reading it in June.
So you didn't have a woman in the 21st century. You didn't have trouble picking up this 5th century. I think I'm right. 5th century it was written, the Confessions, early 5th century.
5th century, yeah. Late 4th century.
Late 4th century? Okay. You didn't have any trouble picking it up and being in St. Augustine's world?
No. I am enthralled.
Isn't that wonderful?
I love it. I understand it. I also listened to Spirit Catholic Radio 24/7, and in the middle of the night one night, I heard a priest, and I don't remember who it was. He said you should have these books visible in your home, and one of them that he said I didn't have was the Diary of Saint Faustina. So I right away clicked on Amazon and said,
and
I have this book, and ordered it. So that's another one that I read, you know, just that's one that you can't really, I don't know, you don't sit down and read it, you know, straight through. At least I don't think you do. But that's another, you know, great
yeah,
book.
Yeah. I think it's there's something miraculous about books in that you can do that. Like it, we here in the 21st century can go back to the late Roman Empire and live a lifetime with Augustine. And we get him. We know who he is. And there's a certain way in which the continuity of what a human person is very. It's almost inspiring. You go, yeah, we're like that. We're just like that. Like people talk about multiculturalism all the time. That's the ultimate in reading books where you are in the person of Saint Augustine, you know, or something like that. That's the ultimate multiculturalism.
Right. And even though the Bible has in many ways shaped our culture, there's a lot in the Old Testament, especially, but in the New Testament too, that is not part of our culture. And reading the Old Testament and getting a sense of it, it enriches us from a multicultural perspective. And the same thing applies to Augustine's Confessions, which is really, you know, what's going on in North Africa, you know, in the life of this person who is a part of the Roman Empire, you know, in the 4th century.
Yeah, right. Thanks very, very much, Peggy. Really appreciate that call. We're talking books. Let's go to Gary in Cleveland, Ohio, listening on AM 1260, The Rock, run by my friend Bernadette Boguski. Go ahead, Gary. Oh, Jerry, excuse me.
Hi. Yes, thank you. I wanted to put in a word for the book called A Doctor at Calvary by the French surgeon Pierre Barbet, who wrote it, I think, first in the 30s and then maybe revised it. If you're familiar with it, I'm happy to step back and let you.
No, it's just kind of horror. I mean, in a certain way, it's kind of horrifying, but edifying because you have this medical doctor giving you what happened to Jesus.
Right.
Yes. And it was just in my own case, a very important catalyst.
What was the effect it had on you, Jerry?
It began a process that got me back to confession after a long time away.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yes. Identifying with Christ's suffering, do you think, got moved you to say, I got to get back to confession?
Yes, in a word. It just pulled it all together from, you know, the perspectives of archaeology and history and scripture and literature. And it was, I thought, a minor masterpiece by a layman too, and also one of the other facts is that put me on to a pretty enduring devotion to the Holy Shroud of Turin. He concludes, and so do I, frankly, that you know, it probably is what everybody kind of suspects it to be.
Yeah.
It's certainly the burial cloth of a crucified, you know, first century Semitic male in his 30s, you know, and you can
by the name of Jesus from the town of Nazareth. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, we can't endorse that. I mean, of course, I don't want to. This is not the teaching of the Catholic Church or anything. But I'm just saying, I tend to agree with you, Jerry.
You're waiting for them to find a special presentation of the Jesus' driver's license associated with the shroud. Is that what you need their side?
No, I'm not saying that I personally need anything else. I'm saying I'm with Jerry. I'm saying I can't speak for the church in this regard.
Right. Yes, right.
But,
yeah.
Yeah, but other than a signature, it's clear what we're dealing with. Jerry, I got to keep moving because other people want to talk about their books. Joshua.
Thank you, Jerry. That's a great book.
In Bismarck, North Dakota, listening on the EWTN app. Joshua, go ahead.
Hi. So I'm a huge fan of Victor Hugo, and I have a question at the end of this, but a few years ago I read Les Miserables, and I'm currently about a quarter of the way through The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and I just love, you know, his characters who have such beautiful conversions and spiritual journeys, and the way he writes, he just presents demonstrations of grace in their lives in such masterful and beautiful ways.
That's a great, if I could just say before you conclude, that's an incredible endorsement of an author to say that the person depicts grace, because this is about the hardest thing that you can do. But go ahead, Victor Hugo, Les Miserables, The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Go ahead, continue.
Yeah. And I mean, through both of those books, he has this obvious passion for justice. You know, he's very, very deep anti-death penalty themes throughout Hunchback, and liberty, and how, you know, grace sort of sets us free. You know, he kind of attaches a political kind of side to it in Les Mis, but it's always, you know, obviously the whole way through, all about grace and faith. And so that's, you know, the way he writes is such, you know, it's so obvious that he's very, very personally attached to that. And yet he had such a controversial and scandalous personal life. My question is, what do you think of Victor Hugo? What do you make out of him?
Which is the old artist in the art question.
Yeah, the artist in the art issue. And oftentimes, artists see better than they live.
We all, Caravaggio, most of us, for example.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Exactly right. And, and that's true of most of us. You know, those of us do apologetics and do teaching theology and things of that sort know that we're often much more pious in how we sound than how we live. And I think that that's true of writers. And sometimes writers see things that actually, and they allow other people to see things that, were you to summarize what is being seen in a proposition, the writer would say, I think that's false. And this happens with respect to religion a lot. You know, people who are sometimes you get atheists or agnostics or people of heretical or aberrant faith, and yet they're able to depict something that's true. That's an aspect of the faith, and I think that's partly because I don't think creative inspiration is wholly a human thing. I think that there's a bit of the divine that comes into play, and sometimes it works even contrary to the philosophy or the ideas or the life choices of the people that do the writing.
Because they're depicting, it's the case with Caravaggio as well, trying to depict the truth, and they're just very, very good at depicting the truth, maybe not even picking up how well they are depicting the truth.
That's right. I wanted to, before we go, though, I want to ask you, Cy.
Yes.
You mentioned Lord of the Rings. Is there a book that you've read that that has contributed to your faith, but that isn't quite so Catholic-y like Lord of the Rings?
The only thing I can think of is Lost in the Cosmos by Walker Percy, but that's kind of Catholic-y. I'm sorry, I kind of failed. What do you got?
That's
what,
okay.
What, Brideshead Revisited? No, that's very Catholic-y.
Those are all very Catholic.
I can't come up with it.
You have me back, and I'll talk about science fiction books that I've read, written by atheists, that helped me become better Christian or better Catholic. Have
Walter,
you back.
Walter Miller? Wait, he was a Catholic.
We'll talk about it. The list is very long, but we'll talk about it.
All right, Mark Brumley, thank you very, very much. I can't believe you and I got through an hour on books. No Flannery O'Connor, no Walker Percy. I believe that we both need to go to confession on Saturday.
Yeah.
Read Love in the Ruins. Read The Thanatos Syndrome. I'm just going to keep naming books until we go. Read Wise Blood. You want to definitely read the short stories. A good man is hard to find.